From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and it's Here and Now, and we are following a lot of breaking news today, including news that the head of the Boy Scouts, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, told the organization today that the ban on gay leaders in the Boy Scouts cannot be sustained, those are his words, and he wants it revised sooner rather than later.
Remember, we reported in April on this ban on actually adults in scouting, and the New York Council at that time hired a gay Eagle Scout to be a camp counselor in defiance of that ban. So we will watch that story breaking today. But let's go to Santa Barbara to start, where oil company workers and federal regulators are excavating that pipe that ruptured on Tuesday to find out what caused the break that spilled as much as 105,000 gallons along the Santa Barbara coast. California Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency in Santa Barbara County. Officials have closed a number of beaches in that area with Memorial Day just ahead. Lance Orozco is news director at KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. And Lance, we know you've been to the site. Can you smell it? What can you see?
Well, Robin, it really is kind of distressing because as you walk on the beach there, I mean, there is oil everywhere. It's on the rocks. You can smell it. It gets on your shoes. And then offshore, you can actually see some of the strands of the oil slick out there. It's actually a 9-square-mile oil slick, and it's not one contiguous slick, but it basically there's one strand of it which stretches east down towards Santa Barbara, and another stretches sort of northwest, sort of out towards the ocean. And to kind of give you a locator on this, because everybody talks about Santa Barbara, and I think everybody around the country is familiar with that, this spill is about 20 miles west of Santa Barbara. It's a beautiful, beautiful area where there's two state parks, and both of the state parks have been closed by this. And this area is rugged cliffs, beautiful beaches. There's no housing or no development out there. Two very popular campgrounds, and the beaches are really well known because you can literally go swim out a couple hundred feet and swim with the dolphins, and you can often see whales just right offshore. So it's a very beautiful area, which sort of makes the spill even more distressing.
Well, we know the break and the pipe has been plugged. How was it detected?
Well, at first, there were conflicting accounts about this because one of the first reports came in from Santa Barbara County Fire Department officials because a woman had reported smelling a strong oil smell near the beach. But yesterday, officials with this pipeline company that's involved in this, Plains All American Pipeline, which is based in Houston, their chairman told us that what happened was some company officials had problems with two of the pumps that are part of this pipeline system around 11 a.m. on Tuesday. Then an employee who was monitoring the pipeline noticed some what they called abnormalities with the pressure in the pipeline around 11:30, so about a half hour later. He shut down the system at that point. They sent somebody out to check the pipeline for possible problems, and that's when the break was discovered around 1:30. Yeah. So the company actually discovered it and shut it down, but at the same time, Santa Barbara County fire authorities had been alerted to the problem because people at the beach could start to smell the oil.
Well, I'm sure it's not lost on people there that this is where the environmental movement started, was launched in 1969 after a much larger spill there. And at that time and shortly after, the thinking was to shift from using tankers two pipelines, and then here you have this break. Just briefly, what are people there saying?
Well, one of the big concerns, obviously, has always been about oil development here. I mean, Santa Barbara County, very, very heavily regulated. And one of the compromises that was made years ago was instead of having tankers to come pick up oil, was to use pipelines. That shift happened in the 1980s. Obviously, people are still going to be concerned about this. This is going to make people look very closely, I think, at all the pipelines in our area because people are going to say, can this happen again? Mm-hmm. This pipeline hasn't had any breaks. It's had a good safety record since 1987.
Yeah.
But still, people are going to be asking questions.
That's right. Lance Orozco, news director at KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to the disturbing news out of Syria, where today ISIS has taken the historic archaeological site at Palmyra, and there are concerns the militants might destroy some of the priceless ruins there, just as they've done in Iraq. Amr al-Azam is the former director of the Science and Conservation Laboratories at the Department of Antiquities in Syria. He's now associate professor of anthropology and Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. He's with us from WOUB in Athens, Ohio. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And first, tell us more about Palmyra. It was known as the Venice of the Sands. What is there?
Palmyra is a World Heritage designated site. It sits right on the edge of the Syrian desert and straddled the very long and very important trade route, otherwise known as the Silk Road, that brought goods all the way from the Far East, China, to the region, and or what would have been the Eastern Roman Empire, and then from there onto the West and the heart of Europe. The city itself certainly during the first, second, third centuries, was a very important center, was very prosperous, and because of the exceptional preservation conditions there due to the arid climate, it has also yielded really wonderful material artifacts and small pieces of textile all the way from China. There have even been mummies recovered, natural mummification, not the sort of mummies you find in Egypt, but this is due to the desiccation caused by the dry climate there. And the city itself, that's the ancient site itself, includes all the features that you would expect in a Roman city of that time, the main thoroughfare, the colonnade, the Arch of Triumph. And all of these are found in this one location, the city of the ancient city of Palmyra, and obviously the modern city associated with it right next to it.
And why this particular place? What is so significant about this geographically that led it to become this crossroads of trade?
Well, it sits right on the edge of the desert, like I said, so it acted as an important contact between the non-sedentary Bedouin tribes that would have roamed the deep deserts of Syria. They would have extended all the way down south into what is today eventually modern Saudi Arabia, and the sedentary sort of, if you want, quote-unquote, civilized cities, towns, and, you know, major centers of commerce up to the north. So you'd have had this trade going back and forth, and it would have been an outpost also to keep this is all in antiquity, of course, to keep the roaming desert tribes in check and make sure that they don't raid the sedentary sort of settlements of the empires.
And now, as we know, ISIS has taken control of this city. What are your concerns at this point? Do you expect that some of these antiquities, these ruins, are going to be destroyed as ISIS has done in other places?
Well, certainly. I mean, ISIS's interest in cultural heritage is very well known, and their interest is twofold. On the one hand, they recognize that cultural heritage is a lootable major source of revenue for them, and particularly Palmyra is very vulnerable because of the kind of quality of material that is likely to be generated from that site. It's all very high end. The other thing that ISIS regularly or has been known to do is commit what I refer to as cultural heritage atrocities. This is where ISIS will, you know, destroy sites or museums like they did in Mosul in Iraq or in Nineveh. And we are very concerned that Palmyra as a site is very much a potential target as well, because it's a World Heritage Site, and it's because it has these very important features such as the Temple of Bel. It's a pagan temple. It will make that a very likely target. Also, in the Christian period, the temple was converted to a church, so there's also remnants of frescoes from that period. And if ISIS wanted to commit a cultural heritage atrocity, that would be one of the sites they would want to sort of blow up. So there's that, you know, dual purpose for them. On the one hand, they can generate a lot of revenue by looting the site, and at the same time commit a cultural heritage atrocity in order to propagate and push their propaganda message. And this is a very powerful message that they use these atrocities for. It's a message of, I can act with impunity, I as in ISIS. ISIS can act with impunity, and the international community is impotent to stop them. So this impunity-impotence sort of combination is really, really powerful as propaganda, and they use it to good effect, and a place like Palmyra will offer them that opportunity.
Well, is there anything that can be done about it as you see it? And of course, those who might be able to help and stop ISIS have to balance the real lives that are being lost in other places against saving cultural heritage sites.
Well, saving cultural heritage should not be a question or an issue. You know, I strongly believe as well that cultural heritage is as important as lives, because lives are obviously important for now, but cultural heritage is also important for the future of Syria. One day this conflict will end, and Syrians will have to rally around what few symbols help them identify who they are and what makes them a Syrian. And their cultural heritage is going to be absolutely critical for that. So saving their cultural heritage, or saving their past for that matter, is like also saving their future. So I don't see a one or the other here. But looking at what can be done, I think in real terms, very little could have been done. ISIS, you know, clearly decided that it was going to reduce its operational activity up in the north of Syria. It's seen that the Syrian regime has been under pressure in other parts by a reinvigorated opposition, Syrian opposition. So it took advantage of that and attacked the regime at a vulnerable spot. And there's nothing we could have done about it, I don't think, given the current policy by the international community and by the United States in terms of how to deal with the ISIS issue. Nothing could have stopped that.
That's Amr al-Azam, who was the director of science and conservation laboratories at the Department of Antiquities in Syria, now is an associate professor of anthropology and Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University in Ohio, joining us from WOUB in Athens, Ohio. Amr al-Azam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And now an update on a story we brought you about a University of Massachusetts Amherst student who died of a heroin overdose in 2013, a little while after he'd been busted by campus police for dealing the drugs LSD and Molly. At that time, campus police offered to drop charges and not tell his parents if he turned informant, which he did. His body was found by his parents when they came to visit on Parents' Day. They also later found texts on his cell phone, apparently from his heroin dealer. His mother now says those texts have long been in the hands of the Northwestern District Attorney's Office in Western Massachusetts. And while she remained anonymous in initial reporting of this story by UMass students working with the Boston Globe, she's now going public because she says investigators are taking too long, 19 months. Francesca Sinicori joins us from New Jersey by Skype. And Francesca, you know you have our condolences.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what were the texts that you read on his phone and responded to?
Well, they were going back and forth on texts about the dealer picking up drugs in Springfield and how far away he was and everything else. And then the last text was, I'm here. I texted him and I said, you know, I used a few words that I can't use here, but I said, you killed my son and I hope you rot in hell.
Well, let's bring in Eric Bosco. He's now a graduate of UMass Amherst, but when we spoke last, he was one of the students. Another notably was Kayla Marchetti. In this investigative journalism class at Amherst who covered this story and then wrote about it further with the Boston Globe, remind people what happened. A lot of people were shocked to find out about an informant program.
Right. So immediately after, almost immediately, the chancellor suspended the use of informants on campus and called for a review board to review it. Yeah. And about 3 months after that, in January, they released the report and ultimately ended the confidential informant program on campus.
And you also took this information that Francesca found on the cell phone, these texts. What did you find out about that?
Right. So the texts from Eric's heroin dealer showed a pretty clear trail of him bringing Eric the heroin that night. And Francesca gave us, as well as the university after the article, the name of this dealer. And I did a little research and investigating and found that this person, this dealer, was actually a teaching assistant at the university.
So what did the school do when you reported that this was actually somebody who was an assistant there?
Right. So after that initial reporting, the university told me that that student was no longer affiliated with the university.
And therefore, what, they couldn't do anything?
They wouldn't answer anything beyond that.
Yeah. Well, Francesca, start with the informant program being dropped. Isn't that something? I mean, you did affect some change.
Here's the thing. If Eric never printed that story, this investigation would be nowhere. My son passed away October 4th, 2013. The police took his phone and computer, and I didn't receive it back until a month later. They told me upon giving me my phone back, well, my son's phone back, that they had enough information on that phone to make at least a dozen arrests. When I asked them if they could keep me in the loop, the answer was no. It's all confidential. I was still in shock, so I just let it go, and I just trusted that they would do their job. When Kayla and Eric contacted me to do this story, they went and they did the investigation themselves, and it wasn't until, I would say, about 8 months later that I found out that they used my son as a confidential informant. They completely ignored their policies and procedures that they themselves wrote, because apparently when somebody is caught with drugs on campus, up to age 21, the parent gets a call and they either get an automatic suspension or they get expelled. None of these things happened. Had they happened, I would have been up there that second, whether it was 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, I would have been there and gotten my son and gotten him the help that he needed.
So you're saying, just to be clear, first of all, you discover your son dead of a heroin addiction you didn't even know he had. But it wasn't until 8 months later that you found out that the school knew that he was at least dealing in drugs and made him an informant. You didn't know that for 8 months.
Nothing. I knew nothing. And nothing happened until the story hit the front page of the Globe. I mean, the whole idea of that story was to raise awareness that an addict could be anybody. I mean, here you have my son. He was an honor student. There were no signs whatsoever of an addiction. He maintained his grades. He was a kinesiology major. We're talking about physics and calculus and things like that. And his grades never dropped a bit. He was just him. So when I agreed to do that story, the whole purpose was to raise awareness that, you know, an addict isn't necessarily the kid living on the street in East L.A.
The most troubling part for me was the fact that when Eric was busted in his dorm room, among, you know, the LSD and the Molly that he was busted for was a hypodermic needle. And, you know,
it should have been a clue.
It should have been a clue. And it should have been a clue that Francesca was in on and that she should have, you know, been able to act on. So
that's Eric Bosco, one of the students at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who investigated the heroin overdose death of their fellow student Eric Sinicori 19 months ago. His mother, Francesca, wants some legal action taken. She says the name of the apparent dealer is right there on her son's cell phone. And Francesca, pick up there. As you know, the DA's office in northwestern Massachusetts has said investigations, especially involving a death, normally take this long.
That's bull. That's absolute bull. I read stories every day about kids overdosing and the dealer getting arrested, getting charged with manslaughter. I mean, the very next day. So I don't want to hear 19 months later that they're still investigating, which I truly do not understand what they're investigating when all of the information that they need is clearly on my son's cell phone.
Well, and Francesca, what is this about for you? Is this about justice for your son or is there something bigger here?
Well, number one is justice for my son, justice for every kid actually out there. I would at the very least, I would like him to be arrested for dealing. That's the very least. But in the bigger picture, if dealers were arrested for manslaughter, I really truly believe there'd be less dealers out there, less access to this stuff, and possibly just killing it altogether.
Well, Francesca, just a terrible loss. Your anger, Your outrage at a dealer is understandable. But, you know, what would you say to the notion that your son was a dealer too, not of heroin, and that people have responsibility if he made the choice to do heroin?
I get all that.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I agree. But my whole thing with the school is if I would have gotten the heads up, now everybody argues he was an adult, nobody should have told me. However, UMass has policies and procedures in place. Now, I don't want to say I could have saved my son, but here's the thing. I'll never know that, will I?
Yeah. What would you want us to know about him?
He was so full of life. He had a heart of gold, so intelligent. Even in grade school, he'd come off the bus. The homework would be done. This is the kid that never had to study, but yet took all these AP classes. He had common sense as well. And I know, you know, you could say, really, he took this drug, but he thought he was invincible. And I believe most teenagers believe they're invincible. You know you should stop, but you can't. And it clearly said that on his phone as well, in all his text messages, that he was going to come home and tell us and get help. His friend said, no, don't do that. Your parents won't let you come back to UMass. And what I say to those kids is, well, you tried to help your friend. Look what happened.
You tried to keep him from talking to his parents. Look what happened.
Yeah, the only people who can possibly help them is their parents. That's it.
Well, Francesca, we know you set up a scholarship to honor your son, Eric, the Eric Sinicori Memorial Foundation Scholarship. You were at the school to kickstart that.
It's to help keep kids off of the streets by sponsoring financial need-based kids in sports programs.
Well, this must have been very, very hard for you to go jumpstart that scholarship program. This is graduation season. This has got to be very, very hard for you.
Yeah, he was supposed to graduate with Eric Bosco.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself thinking about this, Eric? I mean, there are a lot of young people who find themselves graduating and someone gets left behind for whatever the reason. There's a fork in the road for a lot of young people this time of year. You're nodding.
Absolutely. Heroin is something, and drug addiction is something that has taken the lives of way too many young people. I mean, everybody that I talk to knows they've had friends taken away or friends in rehab. Or it's just something that doesn't miss anybody, no matter where you're from, what your background is, how smart you are. Doesn't matter.
Well, Eric Bosco, are you going to continue reporting on Francesca Sinicori's son's story?
Absolutely. I'll be here waiting for the DA to take action for anything else to happen. Absolutely.
Yeah. Francesca, that's got to be some solace.
Oh, you don't know how much I appreciate him.
That means a lot. Thanks.
No, thank you.
Of course. Yeah.
That's Francesca Sinicori, the mother of Eric Sinicori, the University of Massachusetts Amherst student who died of a heroin overdose in 2013. And she is asking for the apparent drug dealer in that case to be prosecuted. Eric Bosco is the UMass student, now graduate, and looks like you have a position at the Globe.
Yeah. I'll be starting an internship, an investigative internship there in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Our best to both of you.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
And that sound you heard yesterday was high schoolers in Maryland cheering as that state decided to remove the parallel parking requirement from the road test, joining Virginia and D.C. The Maryland MVA says, it's redundant. We already have a reverse two-point turnabout, same skills. But wait, what if someday you need the magic never-fail K-turn? Georgina Ewing owns the Perry Hall Driving School in Baltimore. Georgina, you say what on no more parallel parking?
Well, unfortunately, I think they do need to have that skill. Not everyone has a driveway to pull into or will do a perpendicular park. Mm-hmm. And as we travel out and about in our ventures, even into other states, we may be in a position where we have to parallel park the car.
Sure.
So it's definitely not something that can't hurt us.
Well, some teachers in your area are telling reporters it's being eliminated because people can't do it. There's such a fail rate. But that idea that it's needed, big debate in my extended family, especially when my nephew somehow caught the front of my bumper on the back of the car he was trying to parallel park next to, ripping my bumper off like a tuna can lid. But he kept saying, well, I don't need to do this. You say they do.
Well, yeah, I think it's a skill that's important. It allows them to learn gas and brake control, their mirrors, things of that nature. And what happens when they get to a place where they have to park, they have no other options, and they don't know that skill. And you had mentioned earlier about the fact that the MBA said, you know, that people are failing the test. And I think that has a little bit to do with this, in that they're failing the test, therefore they have to do it again, which means the MBA has to reschedule the person who failed. That takes more time, more labor, more hours. And as much as I'm not wanting to talk against the MBA, the bottom line is that costs them money when they have to retest someone over and over again.
Huh, so you think that's the reason? Well, they say they have this two-point turnabout, which I assume is being able to turn or, you know, change your direction. But don't you agree that there is an easy way to do this? I was taught this K-turn. It's you know, maybe we'll explain it at the website, but you basically line up your headrest with the back of the car that you're parking next to, and then you turn one way. It works every single time.
Yes, there are reference points that are used when we teach kids to parallel park where they have to know where to stop the car, how much to turn the wheel. They look over their shoulder. There's lots of different ways you can parallel park. Some schools have you look in the driver's side mirror. Some have you look over your left shoulder out the back window, and you're looking for the reference points of the car that you're behind, which is represented by cones at the MVA. And this is the kind of stuff that we teach in driver's ed. And the MVA is wanting us to continue to teach the parallel park in driver's ed, which we will do. But I'm going to be honest with you. There will be a lot of schools that will say, oh, I'm not going to take time to do that. They're not going to test them for it.
Yeah. Well, by the way, do you think all of this is going to be a moot point? Because we're talking about driverless cars. Do you think you're going to be obsolete?
I think eventually we will. I think eventually driver's ed is going to be something, and it's already done in many states, where it's going to be online. and then you're going to go down and take a driving test at any wherever location, and that's it. The driverless cars and the technology today is turning us into robots.
Well, not me. I am so proud of my K-turn that I parallel park even when I don't have to, just to demonstrate it. Georgina Ewing owns the Perry Hall Driving School in Baltimore. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your time.
It's here and now, and we have moved down the hall to our kitchen. And today we are going to be talking about Korean food that you can make at home. And here to help us talk about that and show us how to do some things is Mong Chi, who you may know from YouTube. She has a new book. It's called Mong Chi's Real Korean Cooking. Mong Chi, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for inviting me.
We should say, by the way, you're not a professional chef. You've never gone to culinary school. You've not owned a restaurant. But you've been interested in food since you were a child in South Korea.
Yes. I'm always interested in delicious food and healthy food and also home cooking food.
When did you first start cooking?
I think elementary school. First, my mom was making like matchsticks when she was, you know, outside. And then I tried to do it by myself. And then I did a lot of cut.
You got cut.
Yeah, but I never told my mom. Probably she will give me a hard time. You
know? Why? Why?
Because, oh, dangerous. You know, using knife is dangerous. How come you did this? But I know my mom probably didn't allow me to use, you know, knife.
And it didn't stop you from doing it.
Yeah, ever since then, I keep making delicious food. And whenever I taste a delicious, you know, version of each Korean dishes, and then I want to learn.
You know? And in 2007, you started doing your YouTube videos.
Yes.
Why did you start doing that? And were you surprised that so many people got hooked on them?
Yes, my son, he's a computer, you know, science student. And then he said that, Mom, these days YouTube is very, you know, growing. So, you know, why don't you have some good hobby? So
yeah.
Why don't you share your recipes using YouTube? And then actually at that time, I didn't know anything about, you know, how to make a video. So all my making video skill is self-taught. So, but first my video was that, you know, spicy stir-fried squid, Korean, you know, very traditional dish. And then a lot of people right next day, a lot of people just was, you know, interested in me.
They
left
loved
nice
it.
comments, encouragement. And then they asked me, when is the next video coming? Before that, I had my own hobby, different hobby, was like online game, playing online game. So my Mong Chi name is, I got this name from my online game character. And then I changed. So I had to choose one of these hobbies. You know,
and
so
you chose cooking over
online
gaming.
Cooking, yeah, on YouTube, more fun because I can interact with my audience all the time.
Well, and you kept that name Mong Chi.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'm going to change my legal name to Mong Chi.
You are?
Yeah, I'm going to.
Wow, going all the way.
Yeah, Mong Chi is a very special name for me.
How many videos have you done at this point?
Around 246. So far.
Just around that.
Around
that.
I cannot remember.
I think if it's 246, that sounds pretty exact to me. Now, a lot of people, when they think of Korean food, think of Korean barbecue. But what you show in your cookbook is it goes way beyond that.
Yeah. This is food that Korean housewives are making every three meal for their family. You know.
But are these the kinds of recipes that people who are not Korean are going to be able to easily wrap their heads around?
Yeah, I don't. First, I was worried about what if people think that this is too spicy. But actually, there are a lot of people who had never tasted Korean food. They get addicted to Korean food.
Well, and I'm one of those people, by the way. Although I will say, when you look at some of the spices or some of the ingredients in this book that you need in order to make this food,
yeah,
it's not the kind of stuff that many Americans have in their kitchen already that have to go out and find it.
Yeah. So that's why my cookbook, I really focus on ingredient section. So there is all each photo.
You've got the pictures of exactly what it
picture
is.
Picture and also what can be replaced. You know, instead of green onion, you can use other like green stuff. And then we just focus on this. What's the, you know, refrigerator, you know, life, how long you can keep in the refrigerator, this thing. So ingredient section, I really, really focus on because I have been running my website, mongchi.com. So I know that people are so interested in knowing about the Korean ingredient, where to find this stuff. Yeah.
Well, in front of us here, we have what, Mong Chi? Because you're going to do some cooking for us right now.
Yeah, I heard that you like spicy food.
Yes, you heard
so
correct.
So special, but it has to be very easy and simple.
Yes.
I'm sure that you, when you go back home, you are going to look for kimchi. I need to make a kimchi pancake.
Yes.
So this is kimchi pancake. Kimchi is like a Korean main kind of a side dish.
Yes.
So this is my homemade.
Ooh.
I made this 7 days ago, and then I need to make it ferment. Ferment, and then exactly when I come here, it should be most peak, delicious time, right?
Yeah.
So I brought this kimchi for you, Jeremy.
Yum.
What I mean?
Thank you, Mong Chi. That
and
sounds
then
great.
I'm going to chop it up and then mix with this flour. This is flour.
Just a little cup of flour,
yeah,
there.
Half a cup flour.
Okay.
But you can replace the flour with rice flour.
Okay.
So, you know, like people gluten-free, you know, people are looking for that kind of recipe, you can just use rice flour. And then mix it together with the water. And then I'm going to chop some green onion here. So
okay.
Green onion adding really more tasty. And then make a pancake, sizzling pancake.
And that it's just going to work like that. We'll
yeah,
throw
yeah.
right into the
I'm
pan.
I'm sure that you can learn very easily.
Okay.
Yeah. Shall we do?
We'll see.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Okay, sure. So first.
You're squeezing the juice out of that
yeah.
kimchi right
because
there.
I don't want to this all everywhere, kimchi juice everywhere.
Uh-huh.
We need three green onions.
Three green onions.
Yeah. People call this
or
a scallion. Yeah.
Yes.
But it's simple. So far, no problem to follow, isn't it?
Yeah, that's pretty easy,
okay.
Although I don't think I can chop that
this
fast.
This is a sugar.
Yeah.
So this is actually optional. But,
oh.
you know, when you mix with the sour taste, always we need a little bit of sweetness and then
okay.
make it more tasty.
So you're just taking that mixture mm-hmm. right as it is. We've been mixing it up.
Yeah.
And you're just going to take a little bit of it and put it right onto that pan.
Yeah. And we need sound.
Wow.
The sound, we need this ch sound. And then nice circle shape.
You're sort of pressing down and mixing
yeah.
it up on the top of the pancake as it
yeah.
cooks.
Yeah. And then see, this is my nonstick pan.
Are you about to flip this thing?
Yeah, I brought it from New York.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to get out of the way. I don't want any hot
no,
oil.
You can do this.
No, no, no. I want to see you do it. I just don't want to.
How I know badam is very crispy is that I just usually like shake this, and then it sounds sound.
Uh-huh. And then you can tell that it's crispy.
Yeah, yeah.
And
can
ready to be flipped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's flip.
Here we go. Whoa, good job. Mong Chi has done a really great flip.
When I reached my YouTube subscriber, now my subscriber is 600,000, you know, in any days. When I became my YouTube subscriber number was like 400,000, I was so happy. So I did, I flipped my pancake.
Oh, so you flip for when good things happen.
Yeah, so today I came here, NPR, for your audience.
Yeah.
I flipped this for
we
you guys.
We got a Mong Chi flip.
You plus your audience. You want to do?
Okay, you ready?
Yeah. Ready?
1, 2, 3.
Awesome.
All right. See, that's a little, the stakes are lower, but
do you
it
sometimes
works.
Make it at home, pancake?
Yeah.
Like, oh,
yeah.
That's why.
But never this big.
Yeah.
This is a big pancake.
How do you like it? This is kind
it
of,
it looks
you know,
great. It looks very pretty.
Yeah, a little kind of brownish and crispy.
I would never think to have kimchi in a pancake.
Yeah. So if you tell Korean friends or Korean people, oh, I love kimchi jeon. Actually, Korean name is kimchi jeon. So I love kimchi jeon. They will love you.
Uh-huh.
Because kimchi jeon is such easy. Kimchi is always stuck in the refrigerator.
Uh-huh.
Korean housewives, all the time, kimchi. I run out of kimchi, I feel uncomfortable whole day. I gotta make kimchi.
Really?
Yeah. Not only me, all housewives.
You gotta have kimchi around at all times.
Yeah. Here you go.
Oh, thank you, Mong Chi.
Yeah. And I brought these chopsticks.
Oh, you brought chopsticks. So
you know,
you're really gonna test my ability to. Let's see. All right, here we go.
Yeah.
Mmm. Very good. Mong Chi,
that
was delicious.
Give me a description about what it tastes like.
What it tastes like? Mm. It tastes like a kimchi pancake
mm-hmm.
in that you've got a little bit of that fried pancake flavor, but also the spice of the kimchi, and I can taste some of the cabbage in there.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and a little spicy there.
Spicy, but
sweet
very and
good.
Sour also.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
Well, Mongchi, thank you so much. The new book is called Mongchi's Real Korean Cooking. We're going to have some of these recipes, including the kimchi pancakes, at hereandnow.org, although we will not tell you how to flip the pancake. You're just going to have to figure that out on your own. Mongchi, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Next week, the Washington Post Tehran bureau chief Jason Rezaian goes on trial in Iran for espionage. He's the dual Iranian-U.S. citizen who was arrested with his wife and two photographers last summer at his home in Tehran. The others were released. Jason's been held since then in Iran's notorious Evin prison, where political prisoners are held and tortured. He's only been allowed one meeting with his attorney, who says his wife will also be on trial with him. There are two other Iranian Americans also being detained in Iran, and they've all become the center of a debate over whether demands for their release should be tied to the Iranian nuclear talks. Rezaian's editor at The Post is Douglas Gell, and he joins us now from their studios in Washington. And Doug, safe to say, nerves have been a little on edge at your paper.
This is really a serious and alarming time. Jason faces grave charges in an Iranian court. We don't yet know whether the hearing will be open or closed, and the consequences are significant. We hope this will focus the mind of the U.S. government, of all who are watching around the world, to demand that Iran give Jason the kind of fair, open, and transparent trial he's entitled to.
Well, as you well know, Iran says that he somehow violated state security. Do you have any idea what that might have been? They say he made statements. Do you have any idea what he was reporting on and what might have been interpreted that way?
There's no indication that there's any evidence whatsoever to support these allegations of espionage. We don't know exactly what Iran is alleging. The case file remains closed. Even the nature of the charges has not been publicly disclosed. But we can say that there's simply nothing to substantiate the idea that Jason was doing anything wrong whatsoever. He was working as an accredited journalist. He was gathering facts. He was doing what journalists do, and he's ended up in jail for 300 days now facing very, very serious charges.
What is the punishment for espionage in Iran?
The charges that Jason faced carry a maximum of between 10 and 20 years in prison.
Well, Iran analyst Mehdi Halaghi of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy says he thinks Jason was arrested because the Iranian government, when it arrests dual nationals, he's an Iranian American, wants something in exchange. Now, as you well know, there's, you know, a political battle surrounding these detentions, not just of Jason, but of an Iranian American pastor and a former Marine visiting family in Iran. He's also detained. There are calls for the nuclear deal to be contingent on their release. Presidential aspirant Marco Rubio is one of those making that call. Do you think this is about that deal?
It's really impossible to know what's going on in the minds of the Iranians who are responsible for Jason. I think we can all think ourselves silly by trying to come up with hypotheses. Our focus is squarely on Jason and on winning his release. We're reaching out to everyone who can possibly help, whether it's the U.S. government, other governments around the world, and to ordinary people, 430,000 of whom have now signed a petition on change.org calling for his release.
Well, there are actually family members of some of the others who have been arrested in Iran who say that they don't want them to be bargaining chips because it comes with the whiff that they did something wrong. And so that's the only way they can be released in some sort of exchange. They want an outright release. What kind of leverage do you have?
You know, I don't think we have a whole lot of leverage. I'm not sure the U.S. government has a whole lot of leverage. I think what we all need to expect, though, is that Iran live up to its obligations to proceed in a fair and just fashion. Iran has said that it is a country that lives up to its obligations, that wants to reach a nuclear deal with the United States. I think it's important that it demonstrate that it is credible and fair and open about its handling of cases of this profile.
Is there any chance that there might be some kind of outside observer? I know that there were calls from the paper for some kind of representative maybe from another country to be there to just see what's going on.
We just don't know at this moment. This is a court that usually carries out its proceedings behind closed doors. We have asked, and the U.S. government has asked, that the trial be open. We have also sought a visa that would allow me, as a senior editor of the Post, to attend the trial and monitor it. Jason's mother, Mary Rezaian, is in Tehran at the moment. She's also hoping to attend the trial. We just don't know whether that will be possible, but we believe that it would be in Iran's interest to show that it can carry out these proceedings in a fair and open fashion.
What do we know about Jason Rezaian's health?
You know, this has been a difficult time for him. He's been behind bars for 300 days. A lot of that has been in solitary confinement. The conditions have been quite difficult at times, including some severe interrogation. I think the conditions are better now, but still both his physical and mental health remain of big concern to us and to his family.
Douglas Gell, foreign editor at The Washington Post, talking about his colleague, the Post Tehran bureau chief Jason Rezaian, who, as he says, has been under arrest in Iran for 300 days. His trial begins next week. Doug, thanks for speaking with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much.
And we'll follow that story next week. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.